Welcome to Switchblade Sisters, where women get together to slice and dice our favorite action and genre films. I'm film critic April Wolf. Every week I invite a new female filmmaker on, a writer, director, actor, producer, and we talk in depth about their fave genre film, maybe one that influenced their own work. Today, I'm so excited to have writers, producers, Wendy and Lizzie Molyneux here with me in the studio today.
Hi.
Hello.
Very excited because you guys are first sisters that we've had here.
And it's right there in the name of your podcast.
I know.
Now you're going to have to get sisters every week to keep it up.
God, I wish I could. I wish I could fly my sister here and just have her co-host it with me as well. For those of you who are not familiar with the Molyneux oeuvre, let me give you a quick primer. You may know the sister duo from the good-hearted, incisive jokes and songs they write for the Lauren Bouchard's acclaimed animated series Bob's Burgers. But the two weren't always living this high life. Wendy began her career staffed on Megan Mullally's short-lived talk show and made an impression on the actor and her husband, Nick Offerman, enough that they would also continue working together today when that show ended. And while Wendy was already working in the industry, Lizzie got a college internship and pitched a producer on an idea that Wendy convinced her sister to write herself, which actually ended up with the two becoming writing partners and with a pilot that I heard just got thrown away. Is that true?
I think our first thing was a screenplay.
It was a screenplay. It never really went anywhere.
Although it was, literally had the plot of that new Melissa McCarthy movie, almost. It wasn't a mother and daughter, but it was a woman, an older woman going back to school, which, of course, is also the plot of Back to School. So who are we kidding?
Right. Yeah.
There are no new ideas.
Very original.
Yeah.
Even though they ditched, you know, those screenplays and that pilot, they did form the writing team and that got a chance to meet with Bob's Burgers producers after what they called a, quote, long period of unemployment. And as luck and talent would have it, the two got the call back from the show and have been staffed there ever since, now executive producers, and have been writing amazing jokes with this show, but have also been working on other projects, screenplays, other things, and I won't go into detail about that, but maybe they can throughout the show.
Yeah, I mean, we're working on three screenplay projects right now. One is a sort of like a kid's skewed princess movie.
But with an edge, guys.
Listen,
would
yes.
we write a princess story that didn't have an edge? That would be really embarrassing.
Yeah.
It's just a streamlined.
It's just a by the book fairy tale.
Straight
no
ahead.
Comedy at all. You're
and
gonna
then
love it.
Also writing two movies that have come from books. And the thing is, we're not trying to be vague. It's just when these projects that you get hired for don't get announced, you assume that they are a secret for some reason for this studio. And then you're afraid to mention them because you don't want to somehow cause a controversy. They probably don't need to be a secret, I'm guessing. But we're
always incredibly fearful
of just getting fired or talking about things in general.
There's like some producer somewhere is just like, oh, I just forgot. I forgot to announce it.
But right. Yeah. There's probably no strategy there. But then we become very worried because we did work on one thing where it was like made very clear to us that it was to be kept under wraps at all costs. And it like scared us. So now if something doesn't get announced, we don't talk about it.
Yeah.
And then usually the projects die, so no one ever knew they existed in the first place. That's like that's Hollywood in general, right? Everything just, most things die off and you never see them.
Yeah, that way we won't be, you know, embarrassed if that happens.
Right.
No one will ever know.
It's like when you don't tell that you're dating someone and then you quietly break up with them and no one ever knew.
They'll be like, what happened to that vague thing that you mentioned on that thing one time? Did that get made?
Nope.
I've been waiting.
I've been waiting for that vague thing.
Yeah.
Well, we'll definitely keep it vague.
Okay.
This is a film that, for some reason, I still had not watched, the one that you guys selected today.
Oh, wow.
And it was one of those where I knew that I was supposed to watch it, and I just missed it because everyone had seen it, and I didn't want to watch it alone. And I ended up watching it alone in the afternoon. I was like, why didn't I just watch this alone in the afternoon before? So the movie that Wendy and Lizzie picked today to talk about is 28 Days Later. Can you guys tell me why you picked that one?
Well, I love it. I think it's a fantastic movie. I do love zombie genre movies.
Me too.
And I think I might be totally wrong about this, but I felt like when that came out, I was like, oh, this is like the new version of a zombie movie. Like, I feel like it kind of kicked off a lot of stuff that then was incorporated into like other movies that came out, like Zombieland and Walking Dead and all. Like, it kind of sped up the zombies.
It was the beginning of fast zombies.
Yes.
Which were so much more terrifying. Up until that point, I mean, the zombies lived in your imagination maybe as, like terrifying, but something you could get away from. And then Dawn of the Dead, the zombies were faster than you. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. so, yeah, not only were you going to die, like, it was going to happen really fast. You weren't going to have a lot of time to think. And so it totally changed up the genre, I think.
It's a scarier.
Much scarier.
Zombie.
Yes.
I actually completely agree. For those who haven't seen 28 Days Later, today's episode will give you some spoilers, but that shouldn't stop you from listening before you watch. My motto is that it's not what happens, but how it happens that makes a movie worth watching. Still, if you want to pause and watch 28 Days Later, this is your chance. And I'm assuming that you came back because you loved that movie so much and you wanted to talk about it. So let me give you a quick recap on the plot. Written by Alex Garland and directed by Danny Boyle for release in 2002, 28 Days Later tells the story of a young man named Jim, played by Cillian Murphy, who wakes up in a hospital to find a total mess and all the humans gone. Very quickly, some zombies who've been infected by a bloodborne virus find him, and Jim is rescued by Mark and Selena, the latter played by Naomi Harris. Selena and Jim have to leave Mark behind as they try to find other survivors, and they come across a dad, Frank, and daughter Hannah, who join up with them and make a break for Manchester, or really north of Manchester, where rescuers are said to be waiting. They take off on a journey that is full of ups and downs, and though Selena has been hardened by what she's had to survive, she begins to soften up after seeing how much the father and daughter care for one another and find joy in darkness. But that bliss is short-lived. Dad gets infected and must be killed, and a small group of military men whisk the surviving three off to a mansion fortress guarded by guns and fences. But the rescuers aren't all that they seem, and the trio must fight to stay together. So that's it in a nutshell. But let's get back to these zombies, because they're very interesting. Yeah. And I love the concept of the, you know, how the zombie virus kind of works and what that means. Because the zombies in this movie aren't undead. And that's something that you find in so many others, you know, obviously from Romero on. Instead, their inner rage, which was always there, is just amplified and consuming them. So it's an interesting metaphor and this nice twist on the genre. And that it's just different. And I like that he's like, people are angry. Right. They're going to consume and destroy themselves. You know, it's not even like a dead virus or something.
Right. I mean, I guess they all basically just have rabies. In a way.
Right.
Yeah.
And then apparently they based the physical symptoms on Ebola.
Yeah.
Which was getting a lot of, it got a lot of play recently because of the outbreak, but there was also like just before, I don't remember what year, but I know like the late 90s, there was a big New Yorker article about Ebola and about the outbreaks and stuff like that. And so it had, and I guess that led to the Hot Zone and those two Ebola movies that came out
there was
too.
Was Congo one of them?
No, Congo wasn't. It was Hot Zone and
Was it Mel Gibson?
Dustin Hoffman was in one.
Okay, I clearly don't remember anything.
There were several Ebola movies, too, that were based. One was on that New Yorker article, and then I think the New Yorker writer wrote, like, a whole book or something, too. So it was very much, like, alive in the imagination, I think, at the time.
Yeah, there was one. I think it had, like... monkeys in it, which is...
Well, that's how the outbreak started.
Right. Okay. Yeah. It was very cheesy.
It's always monkeys.
Yeah. Yes. It was super cheesy. I want to say it was Mel Gibson. It was really not great, but, you know, everyone was really scared of Ebola at the time, so it worked.
And they should have been more scared of monkeys. I don't know why we were...
Yeah.
Yeah.
We are thinking they're cute. Curious George, huge threat.
Right.
So when you see Cillian Murphy, he brings so much to this role because he has this vulnerable quality to him in the beginning part. Like, he's just so sweet. And he's like, oh, you know, maybe we can find the rest of the world and everything will be OK. And we'll just like, oh, I'm so sad. I miss my dad. And that's just not, you know, what you usually get in a lot of these like leads and zombie stuff. They're like tough dudes and they're going to survive.
Yeah, he has no like killer instinct at all. He is a bike messenger.
Yeah,
and who happened to get hit by a car.
It was interesting rewatching it because they really make that Selena character like she's the badass.
She's the badass,
and he's you know the more vulnerable. Which I think they do a lot now, but I feel like in 2002 that was kind of like it was new.
Also, I have to say, watching it from a modern day point of view, and I know this was only 16 years ago, but what a 16 years, guys.
Wow. Yeah.
A lot has happened. Is it like this movie was like extremely woke? for real, there's only gratuitous male nudity. There's no gratuitous female nudity. Mm-hmm. The woman is the badass. And also, like, the whole second half of the movie is basically like a treatise on toxic masculinity that would be so valid now. And it's crazy. Like, back then, but I remember when I watched it back then, I saw it in theaters, like, those were the obvious values back then. Like, no one yes. would have been like, I'm kind of on the side of the army guys. But now, there's like this idea that, like, oh, maybe feminism is wrong and the alt-right movement. And what, so it's like, it's actually like so, like, predictive of this time in a yeah. weird way. But back in 2002, nobody was like, well, maybe you should keep the women and have sex with them and redistribute the sex. Like, yeah. It wasn't yeah. happening at the time.
Like, let's hear those guys out.
Yeah, it was so crazy to watch it now and to remember who I was back then before all of this happened, and then watch it now and be like, oh, that was such a simpler time, because these seemed like right. absolutely the correct values. 100%. This is where we're headed, and that is not where we headed.
Right. Basically, when they get to the mansion, it's just Handmaids.
It is Handmaid's Tale. It's Handmaid's Tale. It is, which of course was written long before.
Right, but it's interesting to see that. Yeah, you're right. When they get there, that's exactly how they're living.
But interesting tidbit, it wasn't supposed to be Cillian Murphy. The first person was Ryan Gosling.
Yeah.
Ooh.
And also Ewan McGregor was considered because of yeah. Trainspotting and, yep. and his relationship with Danny Boyle.
I feel like instead we got Cillian Murphy, who's amazing.
Right, all of them would have been great. But yeah. I'm glad we got to meet Cillian.
When he snaps at the end, when he feels his rage, we see a full character arc.
Yeah,
and you know, it gets to that point where, you know, you have Selena, who's like, and Hannah, who don't know if he's infected because he is so full of rage.
Yeah,
in the same way that these zombies are. That it's like, I almost like rage is toxic masculinity to me.
Of course,
right, like, yeah. That's the disease.
Yeah.
But I want to get back to the point that you were making about this female character, because I do think that this was kind of a relatively new thing. We, you know, in the 90s, like the late 90s, we were getting kind of Buffy the Vampire Slayer mm-hmm. on. We mm-hmm. were starting to get more of these female heroines.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, Garland and Boyle, I love Selena, but I also still feel like there's a little bit of a blind spot with her, just because there is, in the script, there wasn't that much there for Naomi Harris to grab onto. All it mm-hmm. was is that she was like kind of violent and cold, and you know, she was like the badass. She was a tough broad. And Selena actually says to Jim at one point, you know, quote, "Do you want us to find a cure and save the world, or just fall in love and fuck? Plans are pointless. Staying alive is as good as it gets." Like, whoa, that's, you know, the nihilism of that statement. And I think that it's interesting, because sometimes when I see strong female characters nowadays, you know, since mm-hmm, it's become mm-hmm. a little bit more common, they are joyless, and they are, you know, kind of one dimensional mm-hmm. tough mm-hmm. in this way. And I think that there is a possibility that if Naomi Harris hadn't played this character, it would have ended up, you know, as just a one dimensional kind of violent person.
Right,
or cult. Right. But she ended up actually making a complete backstory for her character to try to understand why she was cold. That she apparently would have to, Selena had to kill her parents to save her little brother, mm-hmm. and that her little brother was already infected. And so that was, you know, her reason for being so cold.
Yeah.
Right.
So I'm wondering, you guys work on a show that really has some of the best female characters. You have to know that.
Well, I mean,
we like them.
Yeah, we like them. And again, we didn't create the show, so it's not really complimenting ourselves to say that. I mean, but I do think, you know, the fact that we have, and now we have very close to 50% female writing staff, helps and I think helps develop those characters a little bit. But, you know, Lauren also formed them as such. So yeah. It's like nice to be on a show where the women are.
Yeah, and
sometimes crazier than the men.
Yeah, and I think the cool thing about Bob's is I feel like each female character is different. So it's not just one version of, you know, an empowered woman. I think that there's characteristics of Linda and Tina and Louise that are all like things that we can relate to, but they're not all the same. And I think that's great to have that differentiation. And,
yeah.
Yeah.
So and also, I don't think they're archetypes either. I don't think there's a type. Like, I think... Maybe now there is. Sometimes when I remember when we were at Meltdown and we did a show at Meltdown, and afterwards, a girl came up and she was talking about how much she liked Bob's Burgers, and I was like, it's Tina. Tina's talking to me. And I was like, I don't know if there were Tinas of the world and then Tina happened or if Tina existing has brought out the Tina in some girls. But I don't think Tina was an archetype when she was written. I think she was original. And I think but it captures that kind of nerdy but sexual girl that didn't have like a voice or a place maybe before.
Yeah.
So that's
exactly. I think there might be a fair amount of Tinas out there. I think she was a Tina. She's at such a pivotal age too that I think that really it's a lot of girls relate to that because of what she's specifically going through. But it's fun. I think we have really great women on our show.
But do you guys? I mean, do you do what Naomi Harris does? You know, what a lot of actors do, where they make up these very elaborate backstories for every character. I know that that's part of like developing a show, but like as you're writing it, you know, as you're a writer on it, producing it, do you kind of continue to make up this lore of these people or?
Yeah, I think especially, I mean, with Louise, I feel like there's a lot of that because she is such a specific personality and I think she has lots of little quirks and personality traits that we need to dig deeper on, like, you know, why does she always wear her hat and mm-hmm. why is she so tough and sarcastic? And, you know, I think those are some things that we've had to dig into as we've developed her mm-hmm. as a character. We did an episode where she got her first crush on a boy and that mm-hmm. was really fun to sort of, it wasn't so much building a backstory, it was building sort of her, how would this girl feel when she got her first crush. And of course it was sort of like a disgust with herself and
violent feelings towards the boy.
But that was fun to really like dig in and think about, you know, I think a lot of girls are like excited about boys and they're fine with having their first crush and they love it. But what if that feeling takes over you and you're not into it? How do you react? So we've definitely done some of that with our characters.
Yeah. And I think, too, it's, you know, even like little things like we had an episode recently where they find an old videotape where Tina had trouble saying goodbye to her poops and would sing them a song and cry about it.
Mm-hmm. You ready to flush the poopy, sweetie?
Let me sing my song. Poop, 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 poop. I love you. Poop, 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 poop. I'll miss you.
Okay, say bye. We're gonna flush now.
Hi, Poopy. Hope you're okay.
Aw, my teeny Tina in a giant poop. Oh, second flush.
And it really connects her to Bob in the Thanksgiving episode who has like a, he's having these sleepwalking episodes where he's putting the turkey in the toilet over and over again on Thanksgiving.
Oh, yeah.
And that it turns out he's been dreaming about toilet training Tina and how sad he was that Tina was growing up. And in a weird way that like connects Tina and Bob in that they both have this overly sentimental side, but it also swirls around like the toilet and pooping.
Right.
So it's like, I think there's way, you know, as the series goes on, you find like weird connections the same way you do in your own life to your own parents, potentially between the parents and the kids and their shared traits and the traits they share with each other. And they evolve like in that way too. Mm-hmm. You find like sort of organic connections that maybe you're not even seeing when you're writing it, but then you're like, oh yeah, that does make sense. That's like Bob or that's like Linda. So I think, you know, Tina and Louise's connection through their parents and connection to Jean helps form them as well.
Yeah. But I think it's always, I mean, that's such a great thing that there was that backstory built in for Serena or like that it just helps make it. It's always awesome to have like a badass female character in a movie role. But it's I think it's so much better. It's like, you know, 50% better when you do have that reasoning behind it. It makes it a real person, not just a character.
Yeah, I don't think a lot of people realize how much ends up, you know, viewers, how much from actors goes into creating like a character is like a full, mm-hmm. and how much writers do have to, you know, I'm sure that you guys, when you write screenplays, that you, you know, you don't put everything into a story, but you're definitely thinking what this person was like when they were a kid or that kind of thing.
Yeah, right. You have to let a little bit of it out in the screenplay. But it is important to sort of know the backstory. I usually wind up nodding to it like in act three when you need to explain the reactions. But yeah, you do kind of need to know it for yourself.
Right. But it is amazing to see what, when you think about certain things, like you're saying it wasn't necessarily going to be Cillian Murphy. Like when you watch a movie and then you find out later, oh, they almost cast this person. And when you try to picture that person in it, you're like, that would have been, I don't know if I would have liked that, or that would have been great. Like you, then you mm-hmm. like how it really, actors really do bring so much to a part two, which is really awesome.
Yeah, when, like Bridget Jones was going to be Tom Hanks. That would have been totally different. It's a male Bridget
Jones. I think
it
would have worked because then Colin Firth would have been Meg Ryan. So think
about
it.
Oh, yeah. There you
go. And it would have been you got male.
Flip it around.
In England.
In England.
You've got Mary.
Yeah, you've got Mary.
You've got notes in a box. That's how they say it.
That's Guys, definitely how they say it.
I'm not making this up. That's how you say
no,
male.
No, you say you've got notes in a box.
I absolutely hope that one of your projects is set in the UK. I hope that one of those, you know, vague projects
Our
is...
vague projects.
Oh, please let it be there. I want to talk a little bit about research, too, but we're going to come... we're going to go on a little break, and then we'll come right back. So stay tuned.
Hi, I'm Allie Gertz.
And I'm Julia Prescott, and we're the hosts of
Everything's Coming Up, Simpsons.
Every episode, we cover a different episode of The Simpsons that is a favorite of our special guests.
We've had guests that are showrunners and writers and voice actors like Nancy Cartwright.
I got a D minus, I passed!
And we've also had people that are on the Max Fun Network already.
Homer wearing that golf outfit is so funny. And there's when he gets super into golf, he's wearing the golf hat in bed.
We've had Weird Al Yankovic on the show.
I was just struck by how sharp the writing is. I mean, that's no surprise because it's The Simpsons, but I mean, like, you can't say that about a lot of TV shows, particularly ones that at that point have been on the air for 14 years.
Find us on MaximumFun.org, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcasts. All right, smell you later.
Okay, welcome back. You're listening to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm here today with Wendy and Lizzie Molyneux from Bob's Burgers. And we are talking about 28 Days Later, a zombie movie, because those two things have a lot in common. Not really, but sometimes they might, maybe in the process. I wanted to talk a little bit about research, and I wanted to get into some of the Ebola stuff that you were talking about, too. Mm-hmm. Because so these two, when they were doing all of their research, they were going on, you know, finding all these reported photographs out of like Rwanda and Sierra Leone. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like the scene with the church where there's all those bodies piled up.
Yeah. It's such a great scene.
It's so scary when you see that, like, that person is kind of waking up out of those out of that pile.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, something that they took out of, I think, a photo of Rwanda where, like, they had, you know, piled all these bodies there during the genocide. Mm-hmm. And it's just, you know, that kind of political message was like an under thing for what they were doing. They knew exactly what they wanted to do. And, like, they wanted to draw parallels between, you know, what was happening in these genocides and what was happening, you know, elsewhere in the world. And I think that horror is one of those genres, specifically zombie films, where you can put politics in that message, and it's just like easy to get. It's not very easy to hide, I would think, in things like an animated show. I was wondering, you know, at any point, do you guys feel like you are putting like messages into your work?
I think on Bob's, we definitely. I mean, I think I don't think there's any mistaking that Bob's is a progressive show. I think that. You know, when we did an episode called the Hormoniums, where Tina joins she's already in an a cappella singing group, and then one of the
that
members
seems about puberty positivity,
and then one of the members gets mono, and then Frond writes a new show for them to do called Mononucleosis that's anti kissing, and Tina decides that at the last minute during the show to not do the anti-kissing message and to talk about kissing, and then she tries to kiss everyone in the audience. But we want to tell this story first of all, but also, like, we absolutely wanted it to be a show of, like, don't fucking slut shame girls for kissing people. Like, you know, like, that's, I mean, it's in there. I don't think it's even carefully hidden.
Yeah, I mean, I think especially with teen episodes, that's true because she is a teenage girl. So anytime we do episodes about her and her love life or her interest in boys or all of that, I think we want to make sure they're 100% positive and let her sort of go through the emotions of whether it's liking two boys at the same time or, you know, or doing a kissing positive, you know, show message or, you know, feeling like it's okay to, you know, have a crush on every person you meet. Like, I just think we want to be positive so that, you know, girls know that that's totally fine.
Yeah.
And it's not meant to be political, per se.
No.
But
I think it's just female positive. I think we're like that with Linda, too. I mean, she's just a very open mom who's just like 100% supportive of her kids and is also just like, yeah, it's great. Do, you know, everything, like, whatever you feel is good.
Yeah.
So I think that's, I think, yeah, it's hard to do political stuff.
But we don't do any politics, really, just because
Bob's
takes place in sort of a no time, even though it's taking place now. Like, you know, they don't have the latest phone. They don't have the latest technology, because I think Lauren has rightly felt, you know, that you don't want to be, in order for the shows to be timeless, I think if you watch a first or second episode or first or second season episode, you don't feel like, oh, wow, this was 10 years ago. There's a couple things that you see, but for the most part, you can watch. It's not like referencing, like, I don't know, the Nicole Kidman version of Bewitched. And you're like, oh, I don't even remember that that happened. It did happen, guys.
You've been thinking about that, clearly. It was right there, the top of your
top of mind.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's not mentioning something so specific in pop culture. Most of our pop culture references are 80s or 70s. So they're things that have already survived 20 years. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, we're not doing anything like, there won't be Trump mentions in the show or Obama mentions or anything, really.
But I think we've done a couple. I think even this season, we, you know, there's been some where we're trying to sort of maybe tap into, like, things are hard or people are feeling hopeless about
the Christmas episode, two-part Christmas episode.
Yeah, like, it's not a direct reference to what's going on right now. You know, there's no specific reference in it, but I think it's just an idea of, like, things are not their greatest right now. People might feel hopeless or they don't have a lot of optimism, and we're trying, you know, but the message is, everything's still okay. There's good people. And
But I don't think you start with a message. I think it's just, we start always more with, like, the story or the character. But then we are aware of the fact that, you know, we actually have a lot of young viewers, too. So we're definitely aware of not being, you know, cynical or nasty or whatever towards those viewers and what, you know. And also, Bob's just doesn't have a negative worldview. And so it would be weird if we suddenly slipped into that kind of cynicism.
Yeah. I wanted to talk about the fact that one of the reasons I think that people responded so well to this movie 28 Days Later was because it wasn't just about a group of young, sexy survivors.
Yeah.
But that it essentially turned a story about family. So it turned into a story about family and finding that tribe that can, you know, help you through these dark times.
Right.
The father-daughter characters for me are, they're my favorite. And there's something that happens when we find them in that story where I'm like, oh, I think I know what this movie is. I can see this movie now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When when they first all sort of meet up, when they've run into the apartment and everything, he's like, this is great. This is great. It's just like the sweetest, like, it's such a specific dad thing that, like, I feel like in that moment you're like, oh, I just love this character. He's this crazy guy who's gonna, like, do anything to protect his daughter, but then he's like, oh, great, there's some people here, we can all hang out.
This is great. It's just great. Of course, a celebration, I'd say. Why don't you all sit down and what have we got to offer?
We've got Mum's creme de menthe.
Great, creme de menthe. Aye. Look, sit, please. Get comfortable.
Where are the bloody glasses?
Middle cupboard.
Ah, the good ones. It's a celebration.
Yeah, and then he wants to get the good glasses.
Yeah.
It's very heartbreaking the way that humans act under pressure or whatever, that he was like, get the good glasses for the creme de menthe or whatever.
Yeah.
And also, I think the movie really is, I think, like you're saying, it's the story of Jim going from being a son to being a father, you know, because at the beginning they make sure they go to his house and they see the parents, and the parents leave the note that says, you know, we left you sleeping, don't wake up.
Yeah.
So his parents are gone. He's an orphan. And obviously he's been a bit sheltered. You can see it from the the way, you know, he's a bicycle messenger, which isn't a mama's boy, which isn't a totally grown up job. And no offense, a bicycle messenger, it is. I mean, I've done every job under the sun, but it's not a job that you associate with like a lawyer or a doctor or somebody with a tremendous amount of responsibility.
Right.
And then by the end, Hannah's father is dead, and he's essentially Hannah's father.
Right.
And
I mean, it
is a whirlwind of change for
Jen. I mean, he's sort of that classic Los Angeles guy who's like, I have a job with no real ties and I don't have a girlfriend and I mean it's
sweet
and not just a terrible
douchebag. He goes to bed a child and wakes up and then suddenly becomes a father by the end of the movie, which is a crazy arc for a zombie movie.
And how long days is this? It's like
that's only
3 days?
Yeah.
4 days?
Four maybe? I don't know. It's not much.
Yeah.
Oh, I mean, I don't know if I could do it, but
it's a great way to adopt, though, through a zombie apocalypse.
Yeah, like,
There's not a lot of red tape.
Nobody's there. Like DCFS
there's a lot
isn't
of
checking in, to see like how you're doing. They're just allowed to just take any kid during a zombie apocalypse. Yeah.
You see a cute one, a little cutie pie.
That's your kid.
That's your kid.
Keep them safe from the zombies.
Yep.
I would keep thinking about this and like being gravitating towards these family stories.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there is a lot of quote unquote, I'll call mean media out there, mean mm-hmm. characters, mm-hmm. which I'm actually totally fine with for a lot of it. Like I love It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
It's great. But you also need a balance of that. You know, it can't all be the same thing all the time. And so there's this very sweetness to that family. There's a sweetness to the family that you guys have. And I was curious of like you guys understood when you were jumping on the show how much America was going to need that kind of thing that Bob's Burgers has. That kind of like good, tight, sweet family.
I mean, I don't think there was a sense in 2010 that we would all need that so badly.
I will say I do think like when we knew we were going in to meet with Lauren and Jim and, you know, we got to watch the presentation and that was the thing that jumped out to me about the show that made me so excited to have the chance to work on it, I think, was mm-hmm. that it had that sweet center to it. I think that for a lot of comedies, I mean, I grew up watching like Simpsons and I think that they always had that. I think there's something like sort of special about a show that can really make you laugh, but then also that you care about the characters. I think it's a hard thing to do. I don't think a lot of shows necessarily always nail it. So I think it was, I mean, for me, that was definitely an appeal.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, I don't think the needing it as sort of a balm for balm. I'm trying to say BALM, but it sounds like I might be saying BOMB. Needing it as a chapstick for your soul.
Yeah.
Was not front of mind at the time, but I do think, I mean, I think that characters in agreement can be just as funny as characters in conflict. A lot of times when you're doing a show like for a network, you're working on a pilot. We've done like a pilot a year for our entire adult lives now. Basically, like a lot of times network people will talk about like it needs conflict. But sometimes I think they're not as sure. And don't get me wrong, I love network executives. But like what the word conflict always necessarily means, because like there's shows where people like take Always Sunny, for example. They've all agreed to be mean.
Yes.
So there's actually conflict within the show. But what you don't want is characters who are just like going at each other, one of whom is like the victim and the other is the, I think that's where you get into sort of comedy trouble. It's like when you do improv, which is like the school I came up through, is the characters in the scene essentially have to agree on what the game of the scene is and whatever. That like this idea that like your characters need to have, Lizzie and I did this one pilot and this guy gave us notes who's incredibly successful, but he on our pilot basically said like the husband and wife need to be in conflict. He's like a child and she's like an adult who has to scold him. And it's that is a model that has worked. Like Everybody Loves Raymond, that worked. But in a weird way, like Raymond and his wife had agreed on this as their relationship.
Yeah.
It wasn't just like going after each other. But It's funny because we got those notes on a pilot we were working on while we were on Bob's, and I like highlighted them and put them up on the bulletin board and wrote like attention Bob's writers on it, because like that's not what Linda and Bob are like. So there's all different ways for comedy to work. I think for us, working on this type of show works because I think when things get when there's accidentally a mean line in the script or something that goes after someone accidentally, the whole room, at least someone in the room, will react to that and be like, "Yeah, we don't really do that kind of thing." Like,
yeah.
Nobody goes after Gene's body. Gene's happy to be fat. He remembers the ice cream sandwich that did it, and he regrets nothing. Like, I think that's the agreement our characters have with each other, is to be basically be okay with who they are. But that can be like, you don't need them to be in conflict for that to be fun, I think.
Yeah. One of the things that I really liked about, you know, talking about introducing new characters. So, okay, just a quick backstory of this. All of the zombies were, they wanted to hire athletes. So every zombie was an athlete stunt performer. So that's why, one of the reasons why they're so, like, buff and fast, the fast zombie.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
You know, because they wanted people to, who were aware of their bodies and their right. physicality, because you're not going to, they're not going to be able to say anything. So they have to express so much with their,
yeah.
with their arms and limbs and all that kind of stuff. So the guy who played Mailer, the chained up zombie, mm-hmm. he was an added character that they put in because the actor, let me find his name, Marvin Campbell, the actor, they loved him so much. He's a stunt performer, a stunt choreographer. Mm-hmm. They loved him so much, they were like, yeah. So they reshot the scenes that he was in because he was just a low-level soldier. They reshot all those scenes and they had him instead chained up in the back as this, you know, larger character who mm-hmm. has a name.
Oh, cool.
And I think that that's really fun, that you get something where along the way in the process of something, you understand how they could fit into the story and how they could make that story better. Because Mailer is a great character, you know,
yeah.
like he's the,
yeah.
it's the thing that you find in, I think, which dead one has trilogy has the character who, the zombie who's chained up and they're mm-hmm. like supposedly for studying them, you know?
Right. Right.
But it adds so much more to the end when, you know, Killian has to use
him. Free.
He's like
yeah.
a weapon,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah. Although it's pretty bold. I mean, he's just assuming he's not going to kill the girls. He's going to just only go after the other soldiers.
I guess.
Or
well, I guess they've been
like,
the worst to him.
Absolutely.
But if
yeah,
you're so a zombie, you might not have
zombie.
That.
Well, there
reasoning.
Is a little bit of a weird thing with the zombies where you're never sure whether they have a little bit of intentionality in
right.
this movie as
yeah.
opposed to other zombies that
yes,
are just
that's true.
Blindly going out. Like when the little boy that Killian Murphy has to kill in the gas station says, "I hate you." It's a weird. That's a right. Doesn't he say "I hate you" in the gas station?
Remember.
Oh yeah.
He says "I hate you," and it's so weird. It's a thing from a zombie movie you would never see. And there's a part of you that almost wonders: was that little boy a zombie? He talked, and Killian Murphy wound up having to kill him. And I think again, symbolically, it goes back into like he had to kill off his little boy to become a man in the movie.
Yeah,
and blah,
yeah,
blah.
Yeah.
But it's very effective. Like again, it comes from this rage virus, and I know they used all those images from rioting and protests around the world and everything. So they definitely were intentionally trying to get us to think about, you know, the line between like civil, like rebellion and unrest and all of those kinds of things.
Yeah.
So like, yeah, the zombies, you're never sure whether
yeah.
there's something still psychologically going on with them, which adds an extra element of horror to the movie. I
mean,
think.
There's also the idea that the UK has been, that life continues everywhere else.
Right,
and
right.
That, you know, it's essentially what we have done, you know, colonialists with the continent of Africa is just like, well, y'all can keep your problems here. And then, like, we just don't go in and
yeah.
you know, like, there's very little
right.
aid that
it's
we
send sort of
there.
A comeuppance for the UK kind
yeah.
of message of, like, then the world abandoned you when you
yeah, the world,
or
yeah.
whatever.
This is what
which,
happened.
Yeah, which, as Americans, we might not see that message as clearly, but it's probably baked in
yeah,
there.
We're dumb.
Yeah. Yeah. I just think about Doritos nonstop.
Yeah. Cool Ranch.
Cool Ranch. Nacho cheese.
There's so many options.
Yeah. I just think about Doritos and shoot my gun.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. And as we're going to think of some more Dorito flavors. And then we'll come right back and we'll talk a little bit more about zombies and the process of making movies.
All
right. Right back.
Awesome.
Hey, Helen Hong.
Yes, J. Keith Van Stratton?
What's the difference between a layover and a stopover?
I have no idea. What's the difference between optimal and optimum?
I have no idea. Well, what's the difference between an actual conversation and a promo for our new show on Maximum Fun, Go Fact Yourself?
Nobody has any idea.
Go Fact Yourself, the game show with celebrity contestants, super smart experts, and answers to questions you've never even asked.
Listen twice a month on MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And be in the audience for our tapings of Go Fact Yourself in downtown L.A. It's free. Go to GoFactYourPod.com for more info.
We're having a very realistic conversation.
Yes, we are.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm here today talking to Wendy and Lizzie Molyneux about 28 Days Later. Let's get into some things about how hard it is to be a fucking writer trying to break through in this goddamn industry. Alex Garland's first movie was this film. Like he had written the novel for The Beach, and you know, so they adapted it, but he had zero control over that. And I think he had learned through that process and through befriending the producer, one of the producers on that film, that he really wanted to have control. And so this was his first foray into actual, you know, writing a film. Mm-hmm. So Danny Boyle had already done Trainspotting and A Life Less Ordinary, and I think another one before this. But it was this weird thing where Alex Garland said that it took forever to write a script, you know, like constant fine tuning to get anyone to give him a chance to make it. Mm-hmm. But then all of a sudden, the sequel, they're like, oh, this did really great. And they're like, we want to do a sequel. And it's going to be called 28 Weeks Later. And then they were like, we got like a week to write it. And he's like, I'm not doing that. And so someone else wrote that and then they took care of it. But he just thought it was so interesting that like, you have to spend so much fucking time on the first thing, the first, you know, whether it's a pilot or whether it's your first script, like you have to spend so much fucking time. And then all of a sudden, you know, you have to churn things out. And I, you know, like as people who work in TV, I mean, you guys have written some pilots and that seems like it's a painstaking process. And then all of a sudden you have to jump in. And how long do you guys have to like write an episode?
A week, usually.
A week, yeah. Okay. So
you break it for a while before that. Like, so you have an outline when you go out. So you know, it's not like you're going from scratch or anything like that.
Yeah.
But we used to, first couple of years, you got 2 weeks. It used to take a little longer. And it was more agonizing then because it was not, now it's like a reflex to write a Bob script. Like, it's not easy per se, but It's not as hard.
I think also, you know, just through doing the process so many times of turning in your script and then rewriting with the room and getting notes and then doing a table read and getting notes on that and then animatic, you come to realize that it's going to be changing no matter what. So it's a little easier to let go of some of the craziness in your head of it has to be absolutely perfect and say it's going to be, you know, the best we can do right now.
Yes.
And we know that
yes.
we'll also have, you know, jokes punched up and things like that. So I think the first couple times you really, you know, and you're a new writer on a show, you want to do, you know, kill yourself to do the best thing. And then you get a little more comfortable and you've done it a couple times. So it's less stressful.
You have done live action stuff too.
Yes.
But I have to say, you know, it seems like it would be freeing to work in animation over live action. In this film, they were talking about the filming of like a single scene where they're driving through the countryside, you know, on the road.
Yeah.
And they shot for 2 hours with 10 DV cams. And got 1 minute of usable footage out of that.
Yeah.
And they had like the cops helping them, slowing down traffic, everything, but it was still just like 1 usable minute out of that 2 hours. Mm-hmm. And still, even then, it was just like, okay, so how do, like, I guess we'll just use what we can. And that really limits your locations and what you're able to do. You guys can do anything in animation, though. Are there any boundaries of like, you know, no more than 10 locations for an episode or?
Occasionally, like, they'll say, you know, we've been spending a lot of budget on maybe music that we've added into things or, you know, that it would be good to maybe have 1 or 2 episodes that were a little smaller. But
like set in the restaurant and house exclusively just to give it a break. Like,
it's pretty rare, though. I think, you know, if you have a big, great, crazy concept and we're going to do it, all it might mean is that either you don't do it right then, you write a different episode and hold that one until maybe,
you know, 6 episodes later. We really do have a lot of freedom in that way.
Yeah. And I mean, there's definitely, and there's also weird things that you don't really, when you're writing them, because we're not artists and we don't have to animate it. You know, we sometimes, I think, overdrive our headlights and we don't realize it until we sort of hear back from the artist side of the building that this one was tough. Like our zombie episode that Lizzie and I did, Dawn of the Peck.
Oh, yeah.
They had to draw like 125 individual turkeys, chickens and geese or something to populate the screen. And so that was a big, I mean, even though it was taking place at a location we knew, which was the Wonder Wharf, there were new locations at the Wonder Wharf, and then they had to populate every shot there with, you know, so we had a zombie problem in a way on Bob's. They were just birds. But yeah, some of those things, it's not a limit. Nobody tells you you can't do it, but definitely. Or we had another episode where Bob and, which to us, we don't think this way, so we didn't know, but Bob and Fishoda are tied up under a pier. And the water's coming in, which you think like, oh, yeah, in real life, that would be insanely difficult to shoot. It'd be dangerous to shoot. On animation, you're like, well, you just draw it. But it turns out water is insane to draw because the water has to move. You have to not be able to spot the animation cycle.
Yeah.
Water's hard. So we learned, like, I mean, I think in a way it was like now we've been able to do other water episodes because they learned a lot about water, about drawing water, making the water move around. But there's things in animation you don't know are hard until you've written it and then somebody's like, this is really hard. And you're like, I'm sorry about it.
Sorry about the water.
Sorry about the water and the ducks.
Yeah, but I mean, we're pretty lucky for the most part. If we can dream it, they can draw it.
I imagine on feature, I mean, they take like years and years to make those feature films, though. So there must be a point at which it's like a drop dead, like you cannot change this anymore at all.
No more water. Yeah. None of that. Yeah. No more chickens.
No aliens.
I wanted to get into the celebration scene that Jim and Selena and Frank and Hannah have, like when they finally meet this, you know, the four get together and they're drinking the creme de menthe. That was actually shot on 9/11. As news about the World Trade Center attacks, they were filtering over to the UK. So there's this weird added layer of real life shock and delirium on these characters' faces because everyone was essentially wondering, you know, like, what's happening? Are we going to war? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, when Boyle had shot the Cillian Murphy in front of those, like the wall of greeting letters in the beginning, when that came out, a lot of people were really offended because they thought that he was like trying to exploit the 9/11 memorials that they had erected at that. But, you know, he was like, this was filmed before any of that had happened. And it was this really weird reception that he got that he couldn't have planned. Like, there was no way that he was going to know that this movie was going to come out in the world that it came out into.
Right.
And I was wondering, like, as creators, we're, you know, working in a time where shit changes constantly. Mm-hmm. And does that ever weigh on your head of, like, if you say something, you know, like, I keep thinking about there is a Starbucks joke made by a, I think, Danai Gurira's character in the new Marvel Infinity War. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, and it's just like, it's a Starbucks joke that, like, they definitely didn't know that that was going to be received how it was with an African-American character, an African-American actor, you know, delivering that line.
Right.
You know, do you guys ever worry about these random things or you just try to, like, keep that?
The only thing is, like, mentioning character, like, we have a fear that if we mention someone, they might die.
Like a celebrity, especially if they're a little, you know, older.
Yeah, we killed Norman Schwarzkopf and Larry Hagman so far.
No!
Like, we didn't actually kill them.
Yeah.
They were mentioned in our show and then happened to die. But, like, we were talking about doing a Ruth Bader Ginsburg reference.
I didn't want you to say it.
Like, of all the people to say, you can't say Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Like, but that is actually, I think, a concern of any show that's working a year out from air date, is that if we mention an older actor or actress, there's a chance they could pass away, and it's sad, but it could also happen to a younger actor, actress, or whatever. But you don't want to curse someone by mentioning them in the show.
I think the good thing about animation in that way is that we do have a lot of lead time before it airs. So, like, there have been times that we've had jokes, and I can't think of one specifically.
I can think of something too,
but
nothing that you want to share.
No, I mean, it's not that crazy. It was that we had a song Linda sang, it's Thanksgiving, Thanksgiving for everybody, except for Europeans. And then there was the attack in Brussels, Belgium, right before that was going to air. And the National had actually recorded a version of that, but we didn't do it because
it felt like
we had written it about Europe in that moment, although of course we had written it a year before. It got pulled at the last minute, and I think rightly so. Like, you don't want to like accidentally get into a sensitive area. There are times when it's too much, like, no, obviously we didn't mean that or whatever, but that one felt it was just a coincidence, and it was weird.
I mean, yeah. The good thing is we have up until almost right before we air to make small changes. So if it's a quick joke that would be offensive now and because of something that happened, we can usually just cut it or pull it out or change it. But I imagine, with doing a film, that could it could ruin your entire movie.
Your movie does. I think there are examples of that, too. But then also, like, just times can, like, Mariah Carey's movie Glitter came out on 9/11 and didn't do well.
The reviews that came in from Cannes,
amazing.
It was jury selection.
Jury selection again.
Almost everything. And then, now we're being really mean.
I love Mariah Carey. I haven't seen
Glitter, so I can't say.
Glitter is very good.
Okay.
I really enjoy it.
The only person who gave me a review watched it while they were high, like super high, and they were like, it just didn't make sense and it was slow. And I'm like, I think that's because you were high. But that could also be a totally valid review. I'll have to see for myself.
It's a valid review. It's still a valid review.
Okay.
I want to thank you guys so much for joining me today, talking about zombie movies and Bob's Burgers and all things fun and terrible, actually, too. We ended with a 9/11 story.
I know. But it happened. It's real, guys.
It comes up.
Yep.
It comes back around.
Sometimes we talk about it. Thank you guys so much for coming. And is there anything that you need to plug?
God, no.
I don't think so.
I think Bob's has a couple episodes still coming up. We are on Sunday nights, but it's on your DVR. Let's be honest with each other.
Yeah.
And what else?
I think that's it.
Go to see the Bob's Burgers movie in 2020.
Yeah.
Put that on your calendars.
Yeah, put it in just a general, put one of those all day.
Yeah.
For all of 2020.
For all of 2020.
And then I would set an alert for, first alert,
2019.
Tomorrow. And then, second alert, 2019.
Yeah, November of 2019.
You just
keep it fresh.
Snooze that alert tomorrow morning, but then,
And then every day till it comes out in 2020. Yeah.
Well, thank you, guys.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right, thanks.
Thank you for listening to Switchblade Sisters. Next week, we'll be talking to writer, director, podcaster, academic Rebecca McKendry. She's on discussing Deep Rising. If you like what you're hearing, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. If you do, we'll read it on air. You didn't this week. What are you doing? Where were you? If you want to let us know what you think of the show, you can tweet at us at SwitchbladePod or email us at SwitchbladeSisters@MaximumFun.org. Please check out our Facebook group, too. That's Facebook.com/groups/SwitchbladeSisters. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of MaximumFun.org.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.